listening to a podcast of a program produced in 2012 as part of Aloud, a series of dynamic conversations, readings, and performances that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic Downtown Central Library in the heart of Los Angeles. These programs are presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles, which supports the Los Angeles Public Library. To support Aloud or learn about the entire podcast collection, please go to our website, www.aloudla.org. Terry Tempest Williams, like her writing, cannot be categorized. "I want to feel both the beauty and the pain of the age we live in," she's written, and she does. She has testified before Congress on women's health issues, been a guest at the White House. She's camped in the remote regions of Utah and Alaska wilderness, and she's worked as a barefoot artist in Rwanda. Her last book, Finding Beauty in a Broken World, is a singular meditation that looks at a remarkable species in the Western Desert, the prairie dog, and the rubble of war in Rwanda, and she makes it work. Her most recent book is When Women Were Birds, 54 Variations on Voice, which we'll be talking about tonight. Terry is known for her impassioned and lyrical prose. She's the author of the environmental literature classic Refuge, An Unnatural History of Family and Place, An Unspoken Hunger, Stories from the Field, Desert Quartet, Leap, Red, Patience and Passion in the Desert, and The Open Space of Democracy. She's currently the Annie Clark Tanner Scholar in Environmental Humanities at the University of Utah, and among her many awards, the Robert Marshall Award from the Wilderness Society, their highest honor given to an American citizen, and the Wallace Stegner Award given by the Center for the American West. It is such an honor, such a pleasure. Please join me in welcoming back Terry Tempest Williams to the Los Angeles Public Library.
I'll give you a hug.
Thank you.
Terry, welcome. We're so happy to have you back. It's just really, really a pleasure.
I just want to take in everyone and just see. Thank you so much for coming, and thank you, Louise.
You're welcome. Thank you all for coming. This is a really remarkable book, and one of its small graces among its many is that if you turn the pages, the bird will fly on the side of the page. It's really wonderful. One of the many ways you've described this book is a creation myth of your own voice, which I really love. And I wonder if you would just start us off by reading the very opening of the book, which really will give us the premise, set forth the dilemma that you found yourself in.
Sure. It's just so wonderful to be back in this
sacred
space.
You're from this part of the world.
And I was saying to Louise, on my desk, I have a picture of this library.
And I said, really? Really?
And it reminds me where I come from. And I was born in Riverside, California, and I just think we imprint on those early signals of light and smell and orange blossoms. So it's always just a gift to be here and among friends, and thank you. What if there were a hidden pleasure in calling one thing by another's name? Ray Armantrout. I am 54 years old, the age my mother was when she died. This is what I remember. We were lying on her bed with a mohair blanket covering us. I was rubbing her back, feeling each vertebra with my fingers as a rung on a ladder. It was January, and the ruthless clamp of cold bore down on us outside. Yet inside, mother's tenderness and clarity of mind carried its own warmth. She was dying in the same way she was living. Consciously. "I'm leaving you all my journals," she said, facing the shuttered window as I continued rubbing her back. "But you must promise me that you will not look at them until after I am gone." I gave her my word, and then she told me where they were. I didn't know my mother kept journals. A week later, she died. A month later, I found myself alone in the family home. I kept expecting mother to appear. It was the right time to read her journals. They were exactly where she said they would be. Three shelves of beautiful cloth-bound books, some floral, some paisley, others in solid colors. The spines of each were perfectly aligned against the lip of the shelves. I opened the first journal. It was empty. I opened the second journal. It was empty. I opened the third. It too was empty, as was the fourth, the fifth, the sixth, shelf after shelf after shelf. All my mother's journals were blank.
I just wanted to have some space there because what comes next? Are blank pages of the book, which is an extraordinary thing to happen. It's an event within the book to give us that blankness. And you always find a way in your work, it seems to me, to find its intrinsic structure, even as you make your way through what you may not know. You said you experienced this blankness itself as a second death. And I was remembering that I lost the journal that I kept when my mother died, which I experienced as a second death. Was that just the first feeling? It was just shock?
It was. And, you know, I think my mother was not a silent woman. She was a private one. So that month, I just kept thinking, I have these journals to look forward to find out what she was really thinking in her most, you know, in her deepest thoughts. And I'm her only daughter. And I just remember that gesture of opening the first one and seeing it blank, and I thought, this has to be a mistake. And then the second one, and then the third, and then to realize all of these were blank. It felt like a terrible betrayal. It felt like a cruelty. It felt like a joke. You know, I thought, what is she trying to say to me? Does she want me to fill them? And at that moment, I really couldn't afford to think about them. My grief was such that I remember just gathering them all up. I took them home. I put them on the shelf in my own study, and I just began writing in them unceremoniously through the years. And it really, honestly, Louise, I think it took me 25 years to be able to pull this disturbance from the soles of my feet to where I could think, okay, what was my mother trying to tell me? And I'm sure so many of us have experienced, when you turn the age your parent was when they died, suddenly it's very real in a different way. And so when I turned 54, the age my mother was, that's when I went back into that mystery to really think about what was she trying to say to me.
So this is the mystery at the heart of the book, the mystery that you unravel, you fill in lines, but you keep going back to the mystery in so many ways. I mean, in an incantatory way, all the ways in which, what did she intend? What did she mean? And I really received that as someone, after my father died, I found his letters. So you found an absence of voice there in the silence, in the blankness. I found an uncharacteristic kind of surfeit of language from a very silent man. Mm. And it's like, well, he didn't throw them away. So what did he intend? What did she intend? She knew you. She knew her daughter was a writer. Do you imagine, as part of your imagining, that she knew you would eventually fill in the blanks? Do you think that was part of her thought, knowing you so well?
I don't think she knew me as a writer. Mm. You know, I was barely 30, and I had really just written children's books and a book on the Navajo and storytelling. What my mother knew me as a writer of journals, and she knew that I had hundreds of journals. So that makes it even more curious. Mormon women write.
Tell us about that tradition. What is that tradition about?
From my point of view, Mormon women, growing up in the generation that I did, Mormon women were expected to do two things. One, keep a journal. Two, have children. And my mother kept her journals, and she had four children. I kept my journals and chose not to have children. I think it's the only thing I've done, what can I say, honestly? I think there's only two things I've done religiously in my life: keep a journal and use birth control.
It's a great line. But is part of the tradition that you share those journals with your offspring, with your that they're there? I mean, you're recording history for your descendants, right? That's the idea.
They're records.
It's the record.
But there's always that sense that they will be read.
There is a sense that they will be read.
And, you know, I realize in many ways my books are more personal than my journals because I think someone will read my journals. I never think someone will read my books. It's a strange sort of skewed sensibility. But I think my mother intended that her journals be read. And the question is, how do I read them
now?
How
do you read them?
And they have felt like a koan. Mm-hmm. They have felt like a kaleidoscope that I just keep turning and see a different configuration.
I love that your mother actually taught you how to write in invisible ink.
She did. We spent a lot of time, actually. My brothers and I, you know, she would get bowls of lemon juice. I remember she would roll them on the counter so that they were extra juicy, cut them in half, squeeze them.
That.
We had parchment.
I have a lot of lemons.
It's amazing. How many have tried it before?
Oh, really?
Yeah. And then you paint it on and then you light it. We had a few little infernos, but... So one of the repetitions is my mother's journals are written in invisible ink. And Story Clark is a friend who's here tonight, and we were having a dinner party. Story, where are you? Is Story here? I hope she's okay. Anyway, we were having a dinner party, and this chemist was with us. And we were talking about this, and he said, I know that they're written in invisible ink, please send them to me. You know, he was convinced. And I never have had them checked, but it's that idea that these seemingly empty journals have become very, very full, as you're suggesting.
So you were 54 years old, there are 54 variations, and you, it's very beautiful the way you walk us through your life. I mean, you walk us through different phases, literally from the womb to the present time, with your memories of your mother, where your voice came from, your fascination and your love of birds and in your family, and this idea of silence and voice. And one of the first ones, there's this wonderful repetitive feeling as you keep coming back to these questions. And I wonder if you would read the section about your mother and water, 20 to 22. I love that section.
A mother and daughter are an edge. Edges are ecotones, transitional zones, places of danger or opportunity, house-dwelling tension. When I stand on the edge of the land and sea, I feel this tension, this fluid line of transition, high tide, low tide. It is the sea's reach and retreat that reminds me we have been human for only a very short time. I was born on the edge of the Pacific. California was paradise. My mother took me to the beach daily near Capistrano, home to the returning swallows. While my father was in the Air Force, my mother and I played in the sand. It is here I must have imprinted on the rhythmic sounds of waves, the cry of gulls, the calm of my own mother's heart. It is here on the edge of sand and surf where I must have developed my need to see the horizon, to look outward as far and wide as possible. My hunger for vistas has never left me, and it is here I must have fallen in love with water, recognizing its power and sublimity, where I learned to trust that what I love can kill me, knock me down and threaten to drown me with its unexpected wave. If so, then it was also here where I came to know I can survive what hurts. I believed in my capacity to stand back up and run into the waves again and again, no matter the risk. A wave would break, rush toward me, covering my feet, and retreat into the sea, followed by another and another. This was the great seduction. There was no end to the joyful exaltation on this edge of oscillations. And each night, the smell of orange blossoms and sea salt ignited sunsets into flames, slowly doused by the sea. Not a year of my life has missed the baptism by ocean, not one. What is this relationship to mother and water? Breaking waters, we are born from what is fluid, not fixed. Water is essential. A mother is essential. The ocean as mother is mesmerizing in her power, a creative force that can both comfort and destroy. My mother and I came to trust each other on the beach where we sat. Between the silences, we played together. We entertained ourselves. On the edge of the continent looking west, we came to an understanding of the peace and violence around us. Power is the sea's thundering voice, the curling and crashing of waves. Water is nothing if not ingemination, an encore to the tenacity of life. And life held in the sea is surface and depth, what we see and what we imagine. We cast a line, we throw out a net. What emerges is religion in the form of a fish. My mother's transgression was her hunger. She passed her hunger onto me without ever speaking a word. Solitude is a memory of water. I live in the desert, and every day I am thirsty. When I opened my mother's journals and read emptiness, it translated to longing, that same hunger and thirst mother translated to me. I will rewrite this story, create my own story on the pages of my mother's journals.
It's such an unusual mission. I mean, to use that as a canvas, to use those journals, her silence, as the form in which you're essaying forth your voice. And it seems to me that you look at voice, well, you look at it in such a prismatic way, but I was kind of making a list. You're looking at voice in terms of family lineage, writerly lineage, sort of what I call intrinsic lineage, your own nature, I mean, just what rises up in you, and in a lineage of activists. So you're kind of tracing your voice through. Does that make sense? Does that seem like?
And I so appreciate this. You know, I think as a writer, I know the book from the inside out. I don't know it from the outside in, so I'm listening. Mm. You know, I thought I was writing a book about voice. What is voice? How do we find it? How do we lose it? When do we lose it? How do we retrieve it? How do we keep it, maintain it? I don't think it's a static thing. I don't think it's an aha moment. And I don't know any woman, and I would say man as well, that hasn't struggled with their voice. My father was saying that it wasn't really until my mother's death that he found his voice. I think my mother's voice was heard through gestures. So it's not surprising when I think about that she left me all her journals and her journals were blank. Mm. But I think what I learned is that I actually don't think this is a book about voice. I think it's a book about silence.
Yes, it's both. I think that, you know, in you have this marvelous passage which you referred to again in here from Refuge, where when Terry wrote Refuge, which was your, what number book? Was it the first? It wasn't your first.
No.
No. But in that time period, so you actually made this physical, so it was about the Great Salt Lake and its rising, and it was about the circumstances of your mother's death and being a downwinder and your family and the atomic testing, being downwind of that. But you actually wanted to see how you were balancing these two stories. So you ran out in the middle of the night and had them, you had one story Xeroxed on turquoise paper at Kinko's, so you could actually physically see them. And you actually then could look at the balance of the two. So I was thinking that in this book, it seems like it's a dialectic between silence and voice. Mm. Because you come, I mean, it's like, it's a book about voice, it's a book about silence. So tell us a little bit about, when is silence damaging? I mean, you're looking at both. You're looking at when is silence a positive thing? When is voice a positive thing? But voice can be strident too. Voice can drown people out, right? Mm-hmm. So you're playing with that. Were you consciously doing that all the way through, or did that emerge?
Well, I know my own struggle and dependency on silence. I think that's why Brooke and I live in the desert. It is that deep, inherent stillness. Silence, I think, gives birth to voice. Silence is solitude. Silence allows us to reflect on who we are, and it's not always a comfortable place.
No. We avoid it.
But it's a place of choice. Whereas I think when we are silenced, either by someone else, by a culture, by a government, by ourselves, and mainly most cruelly by ourselves, It becomes a form of censorship and abuse, oppression. So I think it's really thinking about where we live in these waves.
Mm, mm.
And I think about Clarice Lispector when she says, I now know where I want to stand. I want to stand in the middle of the sea.
Mm.
And it's that, where do we find that still center in the middle of these oscillations?
And it's a very talkative time. I mean, we're all tweeting, and not me personally, thank you, but it's a time of, I mean, it's finding a time for silence is in an age of distraction is even more difficult to do. Your mother
and I think it's part of our madness.
Yes,
you
yes.
Know, we feel compelled to fill every moment of silence.
You find such great stories to kind of give life to this idea of voice, though, of both voice and silence. And one of them that I really loved, because I will do a very funny rendition of Peter and the Wolf, but would you read the part about Peter and the Wolf? Because it's when you first started hearing different voices and kind of identifying. And it also, it's a wonderful way of tying your idea of voice to your love of nature, which is so deep in your family. So I think that's on page 26.
I was just going to say, you know, I was so completely addicted to the particular album cover, record cover.
But it wasn't Leonard Bernstein.
No.
That's the one we listened
but
to.
But I found it, you know, because it was, he had this triangle hat on, this kind of, you know, I had to hear it again with the voice, and it was a British version.
And how many people here grew up hearing Peter and the Wolf? Oh, that's great. So that's wonderful.
It was during these days on Mormont Drive in Salt Lake City that Mother introduced my brother Steve and me to Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf. Whole afternoons were absorbed sitting cross-legged on the floor before our phonograph, listening to this musical tale. The minute the record ended, we would lift the needle back to the beginning and listen all over again. I just have to say, this is like, I feel ancient. You know? My nieces read this and went,
you.
A phonograph?
What?
I have no idea what Mother did during those hours when we were in the spell of Prokofiev. How do you pronounce that?
Prokofiev.
But I'm sure that was the point. Our time with Peter was her time for herself. Through the authority of Richard Hale's British narration, Steve and I were introduced to the distinctive voices of each character. The bird was the flute, the duck was the oboe, the cat the clarinet, the grandfather the bassoon, and the wolf was recognized by three French horns. Peter's presence became the melody played by the strings of the orchestra. Rifle shots were rendered by the kettle drum. Early one morning, Peter opened the gate and went into the big green meadow. On a branch of a big tree sat a little bird, Peter's friend. "All is quiet," chirped the bird gaily, unquote. And the orchestral adventure began. What I realize now is this. Within those 30 minutes that took Prokofiev,
only,
you'll see that I have a lisp and dyslexia. Only 4 days to compose, I received my first tutorial on voice. Each of us has one. Each voice deserves to be heard, but it requires the act of listening. Peter and the Wolf was also an early lesson on how the balance of nature could be articulated through story. Niche was the specificity of voice. Quote, seeing the duck, the little bird flew down upon the grass, settled next to her, and shrugged his shoulders. What kind of bird are you, if you can't fly, said he. To this the duck replied, what kind of a bird are you, if you can't swim, and dived in the pond. For my brother and me, the cycle of nature, consciously or unconsciously, was performed through the various voices of a symphony. Quote, and if one would listen very carefully, he could hear the duck quacking inside the wolf, because the wolf, in his hurry, had swallowed her alive. Listening over and over to the voices through a family of instruments allowed us to recognize and appreciate the dignity and uniqueness of each living thing in the meadow and forest. Peter showed us what Mother wanted us to know but didn't have to say. She may have been pretending to close the door and disappear, but she knew the lessons. Here is the world. It is not a safe place. But however frightening and bewildering life may become, we can survive our fears, grab them by the tail, as Peter did, the wolf's tail, and make peace with the world. Each voice belongs to a place Solitude is a place. Mother left us alone to enjoy our own company while she enjoyed hers and reclaimed precious time for herself. When she wasn't living her solitude, she was contemplating it.
That was really quite brilliant of your mother to just to set you forth with this magical tale. And your family was very involved. I mean, on your grandmother, you went bird watching with your grandmother, so nature was a really intrinsic part of your childhood. Growing up in an urban setting, I can only envy that. It just seems like such a great gift to have from your family. Even though your father hunted, and that was odd to you, right? I mean, it was hard.
It wasn't odd because that's what we were raised with, and I remember actually being very excited when he would come home from the bird refuge or the marshes because he would give me all the feathers.
Ah.
And even the perversity...
You didn't leave the red feather over there, did you?
No, I didn't, but I saw that. But even the perversity, he would leave me the legs, and with the tendon, you know, you would see the claw or the webbed feet of whatever bird it was. I do remember leaving one in a basket in my bedroom and seeing this runway of flies. And at that point, there was a house rule that, you know, ducks could not be in the bedroom. But later that became more problematic. And again, it's the paradoxes. Mm. It's the hunter loves the animals.
Mm.
But I think after my mother was diagnosed with cancer, the men in my family stopped hunting. Life
really
became... very precious in all forms.
Mm, mm. When you were having trouble saying Prokofiev, that did remind us of the speech therapist. So another way that you found your voice was through this remarkable teacher. I mean, you found your voice, I think, both as a teacher. You sounded like you had an amazing experience teaching the natural sciences to children and finding out that was a great adventure. But when you were very young and had trouble... You had a lisp, right?
I had a terrible lisp.
So that kept you from speaking. Is that right? I mean, kept you from speaking. It made you feel different. And
so it was a really traumatic experience. A lisp.
And what did this speech therapist do?
She taught me tongue swallowing lessons. And I haven't talked about this. You know, it... Louise, you're so great because these are all the parts that I didn't ever want to read. Because I can't pronounce the name, because if I get nervous, I go back into a lisp. But while all the other kids were out at recess, I was in tongue swallowing class, and we would go through one column of saltine crackers, and you would chew it into a little ball. She taught me where to put my tongue, and then I would swallow a certain way, and we focused on S's, and it changed my life. And I think the power of what she did is in the process of learning how to speak, she gave me a love of poetry.
You read Dickinson, you read Robert Frost.
All of the great poems. You know, some keep the Sabbath by going to church. Some keep, or questioning faces. So they were all of the great poems by Dickinson and Whitman and Frost that had S's in them.
But what you made this amazing observation out of this experience. You said, "I did not find my voice. My voice found me through this teacher," which is a remarkable thing. I mean,
and I think. The greatest gift that Mrs. Parkinson gave me was that in the end, it wasn't about you at all. What propelled you beyond your own fear or your own limitations was the love of the poem, and that poetry exists orally through sound.
Mm.
And I think that lesson has carried over because there's not a day that goes by that I'm not terrified to speak publicly.
Which is amazing to hear. I find that so hard to believe.
And yet, you know, after the first few minutes, you're propelled beyond yourself again to a love of ideas, to a love of community. And you couple that with a culture where women were not encouraged to speak, certainly.
Well, there were certain expectations in your community of how a woman should behave. You say, I knew my capacity to speak was in direct relationship to the women I ascended from. And that's a very powerful thing. I mean, you knew your grandmother, you know, you said there were four generations of women present that you knew. But you also knew that you had to make your own path, which is part of what this story is. Be true to your own voice. And you started finding out how to do that when you were very young. In fact, one of the most humorous parts of the book, I'm not sure you intended that way, was when you skipped a class of high school and you went to the university to see what you thought was a bird documentary film. And what was that film?
You have to understand I was a really good student, very responsible, but my loyalties were to birds. And I saw this poster that said, Pink Flamingos by John Waters. So I thought, I love Pink Flamingos. And it's the only time in my life I left school, because in the desert, you know, what could be more wonderful? And I thought, you know, I'm a junior in high school, I'll be going to the University of Utah soon, so I had my own car, so I drove up. There was really no one in the parking lot of this theater. I walked in, I think there were three other people. The opening scene, you'll remember, with Divine in a market with a slab of meat between her legs, and I thought, this is a very different idea of Pink Flamingos. And I was so terrified, I stayed through the entire film, which just got worse and worse for a Mormon adolescent. And to this day, John Waters remains a hero of mine.
Yes, you should meet. He came to Aloud. He was really delightful.
I'm reading his book of essays. You know, when I was in New Orleans, I went to where he had just been. So I just, one day, I just want to say thank you for,
we'll arrange that.
Breaking
that
me open.
Back to this idea of silences. You said your mother, she knew herself and she kept silence as a possession. So let's talk a little bit more about silence again and what it means. You have a really interesting section. You looked at different ways in which artists had used silence or absence of image through time. Could you talk a little bit about that? It's such an interesting, I mean, that's what I love about the interdisciplinary nature of your book. It's like you can, it's memoir, it's art history, it's natural history. It's this amazing way in which it actually all works together, you know, in this drive about voice and silence. So tell us about those artists.
I've always loved John Cage, always, and I've always loved his book Silence with his journal renderings. And one of, again, my fantasies would have been to have been at that premiere of his concerto of 4 minutes, 33 seconds, which, as you know, is silent. And in the Catskills at Woodstock, can you imagine, in that beautiful, I've actually seen where it was performed, you know, that David Tudor opens the piano, sits down for 4 minutes, 33 seconds, occasionally, you know, during the movements, turns the page or opens the piano and closes it. And it's really not silent at all because it's filled with the ambient sounds. And in that particular performance, there was birdsong, there was rain, and there was outrage. And in the same way with Rauschenberg, his seven panels of white paintings, which was perceived by the art world as a scandal of white. And I loved reading about his sensibility of that, that it never stopped scaring him. He never stopped being frightened of those seven panels. And that really influenced Cage to take his love affair and obsession with silence to the stage, to a concerto, and create his own scandal of white. And it made me think, you know, my mother left me all her journals, and her journals were blank, that my mother had created a scandal of white, that yes. My mother had also created a transgression, a transmission, and that she too was a performance artist.
Yes. That's, and she never knew, perhaps, that she was, do you think?
I don't know. I mean, and I think that was the other thing, that the paradox, you know, she bequeathed to me this mystery. But I think with a mystery, in the beginning, I was determined to try to solve it. But what became a mystery ultimately evolved to mysterious.
Right.
That it was right. It was a very mysterious gesture. And when something's mysterious, you don't have the same drive to solve it as much as just to stand in it.
That's so perceptive. That's so true. Then you live with uncertainty, which is another big theme of the book, is that that's there. That's there as a given. And then all your ways of trying to understand it, you're not solving it anymore, but these are all possibilities. It kind of opens up.
And that's the beauty.
Yeah, and that is
the not knowing.
a really great beauty. There's so many birds who wing their ways through the pages of this book. I mean, literally, you can fly through the book. Your mother was, you looked at birds with your mother, but mainly with your grandmother.
She did not like birds.
She did not like birds.
No, all she could
no
think
ducks
of,
in the house.
That probably was the beginning of it. But no, she did not like birds. She thought of Tippi Hedren, is that her name? With Alfred Hitchcock. And so it was really my grandmother. That was what my grandmother and I shared.
And she was such a staunch supporter of your ability to be different, of your ability. I mean, she also challenged your mother on even her belief in the church. Is that right?
She did.
Did your mother leave the church eventually?
That's such a great question. I think for my mother, her religion was set aside and she found a place of spirituality. Mm. Mm. And that was really the great gift of her cancer. Mm. That not only was it a physical transformation, but it was a spiritual transformation. And I think one of the parts that I was most hesitant in putting in this book was when my mother and Mimi were in a great disagreement.
That's a great scene.
And Mimi was basically, and this is between us,
Mimi's your grandmother.
Yeah.
She's
my father's mother.
Your father's mother.
And we were on the patio. I was in high school, and my mother was saying that she felt that the Mormon church was demonic because of the ways in which it silenced people. And at that time, under great debate, was whether or not African Americans should have the priesthood. And my mother said, I mean, my grandmother was saying, this is racist, it's sexist, it's misogyny, and they're, you know, old goats, and I won't say what else she said. And at that point, my mother stood up and said, I don't ever want you criticizing the Mormon church in front of my children again. Mm. And she got up and walked out. And I was staying overnight with my grandmother. It was very tense. And as she walked out, Mimi and I were standing on the front porch, and Mimi turned to me and she said, your mother's about to leave the church. And it was that notion of insistence and resistance mm. and dogma and freedom and triggering and projection. And my grandmother was a great scholar of Carl Jung. And so, you know, growing up as children, I really thought Krishnamurti and Carl Jung and Joseph Campbell were Mormons. So we had this kind of weird childhood of, you know, my grandmother's outrageousness, my mother's grace and poise, mm. you know, my father's and, you know, our family business in construction and, you know, Brooke and my adherence to Endangered Species Act. And when the tortoises were endangered, they were shutting down our family business. So paradox comes naturally to me.
When you said that, you know, that well, I was thinking of when you were, was it when you were baptized or when you were given your patriarchal blessing? That was really something to think about. So your patriarchal blessing from the church was, how do you say it?
A patriarchal blessing, there is a patriarch in your neighborhood. My great-grandfather was a patriarch. It's a calling. It's almost like a personalized blessing. Mm. And I had mine right after, when I graduated from high school. And I will never forget it. I still think about it. And there was one line that gave me permission. And it said, no truth will be revealed to you that will be in conflict with God's truth. And I took that as a translation of my own truth. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's how it was intended, but that's how I took it, as personal scripture.
So your revelation about Eve was sort of a in line with your own truth, that the story of Adam and Eve was a blasphemy, but it was also about Eve's courage.
Again, the transgression to speak,
yes.
Transgression to act, which is where Eve found her voice. So again, that's a theme through the book, is transgression, because I think every time a woman speaks, I know when I speak, I think, am I transgressing? I feel that now, having told that story about my grandmother. It's not something that dies easily.
And you had to learn to speak up in civic hearings when you worked on environmental issues, and there were congressional hearings where a congressman actually looked at you and said, was it Ms. Williams? Did he actually say Ms.?
He said Ms. Williams. This was Congressman Jim Hansen. It was a House hearing on Utah wilderness, and we gave testimony, and in the middle of my testimony, it was obvious he couldn't have cared less. He was shuffling through papers. He was talking to his, colleague. And I just stopped. And I just said, Congressman Hansen, I've lived in Utah most of my life. Is there anything I can say to you that would allow you to see this landscape differently? And he looked down off the risers designed to intimidate with his glasses. And he looked at me and he said, Ms. Williams, there's something about your voice I cannot hear. And I don't think he was talking about the microphone. But a healthy dose of anger is good. It motivates. And how do you take that anger and turn it into sacred rage? And I think one of the things that I appreciate about my Mormon upbringing is the individual isn't important. The community is.
So then you get to this whole idea of voices in concert, which is such a beautiful idea, kind of extending it from the individual voice into community. And what you did, you created this chapbook. You gathered all these writers together, Wallace Stegner, to younger writers, to talk about this Red Rock wilderness and its importance. And it had a huge effect. You actually assembled the voices and put them to use in a way that couldn't be ignored.
We were lucky. It was an act. What can you do? Maybe if he can't hear one voice, he can hear a community of voices. And so Steve Trimble and I basically wrote a letter that to friends who had a relationship to Utah Wildlands. Rick Bass was the youngest. I think he was in his early 30s. The oldest was Marty Murray, who was almost 100. And we said, dear friends, we need your help. We outlined the situation and said, we need you to write the most beautiful piece you've ever written, poem, story, essay. We need it in 3 weeks, and we cannot pay you. And in 3 weeks, we received beautiful pieces of writing from all of them. With the Southern Utah Wilderness's help, we created a little chapbook, as you said. We had a mini press conference in Washington, and it turned into a literary bill with Bruce Vento on the House and Maurice Henschy from New York, and then Feinstein and Bill Bradley in the Senate that said they would accept this and take it into their colleagues. I remember there was a very cynical reporter from the Washington Post, and he said, are you mad? Do you know how many pieces of paper come across the halls of Congress? Why are you wasting your time? I was ready to go to debate with him. Steve Trimble was much more poised and said, writing is always an act of faith. Mm. What happened was the bill died in the House. They wanted 1.2 million acres out of 22 million acres of BLM wilderness in Utah. We were advocating for 5.7. In the Senate, it went to the Senate floor. The Democrats went into a filibuster. What is needed during a filibuster? Words. And Bill Bradley stood up on the Senate floor said, Senator Hatch, Senator Bennett, with all due respect, these wildlands do not just belong to Utah. They are public lands. They are our public commons. And I would like to read from one of my constituents in New Jersey, John McPhee, and he read Basin Range, Basin Range. And then they passed this little chapbook all around the Senate floor for hours. And
yes.
It was all, it was recorded in and into the congressional record.
And the result of that, yes, so great, power of words. The result of that was the Escalante Grand Staircase.
It was a part of that.
It was a part of that, for which I humbly bow, one of my favorite places in the world.
I think we each have a piece. It's that metaphor of mosaic. Mm. And that's voice. Mm. And to me, it's not one voice, but it's many voices, and it's the gesture, the attempt.
So that's this power of a voice, and at the same time, when you say my mother gave me her voice by withholding hers, which is a very, you know, it's really something to hold in your mind. I mean, when we write, you know, to get this, you had to edit, you know, you had to take out, you know, the sculptor takes away, you know, from the marble, you know, you have to take things away. You have to, the things that we don't see that aren't in this book are part of what made it this book. So this whole idea, you say, and I found this so startling, you say she refused to write in her journals. Like, that's an idea. Like, she refused to be known. She refused her role. So if the role of a Mormon woman was to write these journals, she left it open.
I also think my mother's journals were an act of defiance.
Yes, and you come to that, it seems like that's very hard-won knowledge. By the end of the book, I found that so startling. You
and my mother's journals were an act of generosity.
Mm.
I mean, what she ultimately gave me with this, which I believe she knew it would drive me crazy, you know, at some point, and she was right. So I think it's that gift of our mothers to be known. My mother knew me well.
I think she did know you well. Maybe she didn't know you as a writer, but she. She knew you. She knew you well. She knew you well. You end the book again talking about this value of silence. You're walking in a spiral at Robert Smithson's Spiral Jetty. Very beautiful image. You're a vulnerable human being in a vulnerable world, guided by the songs of birds. And you end with another question, which is a question that also haunts the whole book. It's that how shall we live? How shall we live in a world without answers? And first I thought, if we have time, if you could read a little bit of one of the writers who's influenced you so much, Lauren Isley, The Judgment of the Birds, because I think it's one of the ways that you look for a way to speak to this question.
In many ways, this book is a bibliography as well, hidden. And Lauren
Isley, I
found
Isley, lots of people I hadn't read before.
Lauren Isley is a writer that matters to me, and he's sort of fallen out of favor. But you know, one of Mimi's great goals was to live to see Halley's Comet because of what Lauren Isley had written about it. But I found very dear friends of ours in Maine; their daughter committed suicide, and this came out of that moment. And I think it represents voice in someone who dares to say what is unspoken. In the deepest winter of 2010, I was in Maine attending the memorial service of a beautiful young woman. Gifted with words, she was a promising writer who had just graduated from college. From time to time, we exchanged essays and stories. She was smart, irreverent, and undone by the pull of her own perfection. To say that she lost herself to anorexia is to imply that we don't share her geography of panic. We do. I will never be enough. I want to disappear. The collective struggle became personal. She was tired. She was resolved. She took her life. And as a community gathered around her beloved parents and brother, we all bore the burden of responsibility and regrets. Inside the church, all the ushers were fathers, and it was the mothers who brought offerings of food throughout the week to the bereaved house, serving the family as they became guests in their own home, comforted. And I thought about how we each parent each other through grief in gestures large and small. My eyes focused on the elegantly crafted box made by the hands of neighbors, now holding her ashes, ashes, we all fall down. The woods she ran through as a child hold her in memories of maple, birch, and balsam fir. Pink tulips soften the edges of the altar, Emily's favorite flower. Yes, I will speak her name, her beautiful name, Emily. Do any of us ever really fully understand the consequences of our actions? Winter's searing light burned through the stained glass windows of the white steepled church as we listened to the pastor read from The Judgment of Birds by Lauren Isley. Quote, the sun was warm there, and the murmurs of forest life blurred softly away into my sleep. When I awoke, dimly aware of some commotion and outcry in the clearing, the light was slanting down through the pines in such a way that the glade was lit like some vast cathedral. I could see the dust motes of wood pollen in the long shaft of light, and there, on the extended branch, sat an enormous raven with a red and squirmy nestling in his beak. The sound that awoke me was the outraged cries of the nestling's parents, who flew helplessly in circles about the clearing. The sleek black monster was indifferent to them. He gulped, wetted his beak on the dead branch a moment, and sat still. Up to that point, the little tragedy had followed the usual pattern, but suddenly, out of all that area of woodland, a soft sound of complaint began to rise. Into the glade fluttered small birds of half a dozen varieties drawn by the anguished outcries of the tiny parents. No one dared to attack the raven, but they cried there in some instinctive common misery, the bereaved and the unbereaved, the glade filled with their soft rustling and their cries. They fluttered as though to point their wings at the murderer. There was a dim, intangible ethic he had violated, that they knew. He was a bird of death. And he, the murderer, the black bird at the heart of life, sat on there, glistening in the common light, formidable, unmoving, unperturbed, untouchable. The sign died. It was there then I saw the judgment. It was the judgment of life against death. I will never see it again so forcefully presented. I will never hear it again in notes so tragically prolonged. For in the midst of protest, they forgot the violence. There in the clearing, that clearing, the crystal note of a song sparrow lifted hesitantly in the hush. And finally, after painful fluttering, another took song, and then another, the song passing from one bird to another, doubtfully at first, as though some evil thing were being slowly forgotten, till suddenly they took heart and sang from many throats joyously together, as birds are known to sing. They sang because life is sweet and sunlight beautiful. They sang under the brooding shadow of the raven. In simple truth, they had forgotten the raven, for they were the singers of life and not of death.
Such an amazing, well, he's worth being inspired by and being heard from again. And your book is such a celebration of life. I want to, I don't know what you will write next or where the story will take you next, but I'm sure it will be another amazing mosaic, as only you could do. And I wondered if you could, before we open to questions, if you could just read that last passage in the book to give us that last voice.
Thank you so much, Louise.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
My mother's journals are an opening. My mother's journals are an awakening. My mother's journals tell me nothing. My mother's journals tell me everything. How shall I live? I want to feel both the beauty and the pain of the age we are living in. I want to survive my life without becoming numb. I want to speak and comprehend words of wounding without having these words become the landscape where I dwell. I want to possess a light touch that can elevate darkness to the realm of stars. What is time, sacred time, but the acceleration of consciousness? There are so many ways to change the sentences we have been given. We cannot do it alone. We do it alone. How shall we live? Once upon a time when women were birds, there was the simple understanding that to sing at dawn and to sing at dusk was to heal the world through joy. The birds still remember what we have forgotten, that the world is meant to be celebrated. My mother's journals are to be celebrated.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
We're about to open to questions. I did just have to ask you, are you going to keep your journals? Have you designated someone who will get to read your journals?
A good fire would do.
So many of my women friends, I've noticed they tell me they're going through their journals and are contemplating destroying them. And I was, you can't do that. And they were like, well, I don't want my daughter to read them. I don't want my son to read them. So your mother, as you said, she may have spared people. We don't know.
I would be disingenuous. I won't burn my journals.
I'm glad.
You know, just because I value probably the... But who knows, you know? Who knows?
Let's have our first question. If we have one, sure.
Is there a specific expectation of what Mormon women write about in these journals?
You know, we have a lot of journals from... it would be my mother's grandmother, my great-grandmother, Romney. And there's everything from shopping lists to very perfunctory notes about Letty was born today, you know, to my favorite passage is from my great-great-grandmother, who was the first wife in a polygamous arrangement. And it's a complaint. And basically saying, I cannot believe he brought home this wife who is useless in the sugar beet fields. She cannot lift a hoe. You know, she does not help with the bushels. Lord knows only why he picked her in the first place. You know, so there are those wonderful passages. But, you know, I think it's like all of our journals. I'm just curious, how many keep journals here? So, it's what we do. And I know mine run the full gamut from sketchbook to holding feathers and pressed plants to
And sometimes you secrets. Even cover your tracks within the journals. That's really fascinating.
I call them repetitions, you know, where you write a line and then you write over the line and write over the line. And, you know, it's the process that matters. And once I track over them, I don't even know what it says. And I think it's in that moment I realized, you know, I was more my mother's sister than her daughter. Mm. Mm. Is Judith here, Freeman? I'm sure Judith has a lot of stories in her family with Mormon background.
Yeah. No, down here. Mike is coming.
Was there any particular incident that gave you confidence in your voice?
Was there any particular incident that
gave me... To think that what you were thinking and writing had value in the world, because sitting alone, we all write and we think, oh, it's so mundane, or no one would care, or it's not grand enough, or sweet enough. Mm. Was there something that made you confident in presenting your voice?
It's such a great question. I'm not sure that I would use the word confident, but I would use the word desperate. And I say that in terms of loss, that I was 30 years old and 9 women in my family had all had mastectomies and 7 were dead. And I kept having this flash of light in the night in the desert, this reoccurring dream over and over and over again, this flash of light in the night in the desert that was illuminating buttes and mesas over and over again after my mother died. And I remember my father and I were having dinner, and he said, tell me how you are. And I just said, I keep having this nightmare, this flash of light in the night in the desert. And he said, well, you saw it. It was a common occurrence in the 1950s. In fact, he said, I remember exactly where we were. We were driving back to Salt Lake from California. We were driving toward Las Vegas. It was an hour or so before dawn. This explosion, I thought the oil tanker in front of us had blown up. We pulled over to the side, and suddenly rising from the desert floor was this golden stem cloud, the mushroom. And within a few minutes, a light ash was raining on the car. He said, I remember the day. It was September 7th, 1957. Diane was pregnant. You were 2 years old. It was the day before your birthday. I don't remember that, but my psyche remembered that. And I think it was in that moment I realized we were children growing up in the American Southwest, drinking contaminated milk from contaminated cows, even the breasts of our mothers, members years later, the clan of one-breasted women. I could not live with that silence. The price was too high. And it was in that moment that I made a choice to go to the Nevada test site in 1988, the year after my mother passed, when my father told me that story, and with many, many other people from Salt Lake City, Franciscans, Native people from the Shoshone tribe, people from Kazakhstan. We committed civil disobedience. I took it seriously, read Thoreau's essay, read Gandhi, read Martin Luther King, and made that choice in a very conservative Republican family to cross that line. And I'll never forget, you know, crossing that cattle guard, allowing yourself to be arrested on behalf of the Klan of one-breasted women. And I remember the officer, I write about this at the end of Refuge, the officer cinched, frisked my body, and she got to my boots, and there was a bulge, and she pulled out, you know, a pad of paper and pencil. And she said, "And these?" And I remember looking at her and saying, "Weapons." Mm. It just came out, and I think that was the moment I found my voice. And she put it back in my boot, pulled it over, and understood. And so I think on that was, you know, I crossed the line physically, I crossed the line metaphorically. And I did, that voice was out of loss and love. It doesn't mean that there weren't other times that I lost my voice, but at least there's an act of retrieval.
That's a good question.
I think you kind of answered my question. But I was going to ask you a little bit more about the act of transgression that you talk about when writing about your family. And you know, it sounds like you come from that sense of, that feeling that there's a sense of betrayal, perhaps. And when you first had that feeling, and perhaps what the reaction of the family members that you wrote about was.
I wish I could tell you that I was over it. You know, I wish I could tell you that it didn't matter. But it does matter. And, you know, this is tough to talk about this in this day and age, because I'm aware that this will be broadcast. I'm aware that my family can find this on the web. And I deeply love them. But we are here in community. And you've asked a serious question. And, you know, I just talked to my brother not long ago, and he said, "You should know that Rich read a certain passage from the book, gathered his children around, his grandchildren, and said, 'I want to read this passage of what Terry's written.' And may I read it to you?" Mm-hmm. If I can find it. Why are we here? To keep the story going. What is the story? The story is life. Brooke and I were having this conversation on the banks of the Colorado River as we were reading out loud The Story of My Heart by Richard Jefferies, a gem of a book published in 1883. Naked mind confronts naked earth. Give me the deepest soul life. It is a conversation we've never stopped having with each other. How do we give voice to creation? Before Brooke and I were married in the Salt Lake Temple, we made personal vows in a ceremony prior to our wedding day, also within the temple, with our parents present as witnesses. In Mormon theology, this is called, quote, taking out one's endowments, unquote. It is a sacred rite of passage. What I will share is this. Men sit on one side of the room and women sit on the other. Holy instructions are given. The story of Adam and Eve is recounted. Brooke and I were picked to represent the first couple in the Garden of Eden. Honored to be chosen, we stood before the congregation as we stood in for Adam and Eve. Eve was a virgin, so was I. As I listened to this biblical text being read on the eve of my marriage, the only word inhabiting my mind was fuck. I blushed. This was not a word within my vocabulary as a chaste 19-year-old woman. Shocked by the betrayal of my own imagination, I tried to clear my thoughts, keep my countenance clean and pure, but the word kept pressing in on me, fuck, fuck, fuck. A word I had never spoken out loud. I'm not sure I even knew what it meant. I turned a deeper shade of red. Brooke began smiling, wondering why I kept blushing. embarrassed, flushed with a fever. I was experiencing both. Once again, being asked to repeat certain words, this four-letter word kept announcing itself in the most holy of moments, pulling my attention away from the marriage of Adam and Eve to the allure of the seductive snake. I tried to stay focused on Brooke as we held each other's hands. Fuck, fuck, fuck. The dance between the sacred and the profane only became more heated. In this very public moment, I was privately struggling with my own demon. In the beginning was the word. Nobody warned me about which one.
So he read it to the family?
So he read it to my family. And he said, why would Terry write this? And I think my uncle read it because he just wanted to say the word.
Yes, yes. Over there.
Somewhere in the writings of Jonathan Williams, I came across a Conrad Lorenz quote from about 75 years ago, where he said, the greatest defect of modern man is his total inability to spend any time alone, just loafing in his own brain pan. And you're obviously somebody that's happy doing that, but do you think it is a defect, and do you think it's getting worse?
Our incapacity to spend time alone? It's such a great question.
Yeah.
You know, I can only speak for myself. If I did not have skeins of time alone, in solitude, in a place of stillness, I would be mad. And I would not have the capacity to create anything. And I think it's that balance. You know, there are other times where it's, you know, I love being out in the world. I love teaching students. I love being here in Los Angeles. You know, today walking around and seeing this gorgeous city and that incredible place called Louis, where there's macaroons, you know, that, and it's completely thrilling, but I know where I'm going home to. I think without stillness, without solitude, without spending time alone, that is, as we talked about, is not a comfortable place. It's terrifying at times. Our imagination is not fueled, at least for me. But other people have different requirements. I have friends that will do anything not to be alone, and they are creative people. So maybe it's one's propensity for where one feels at home.
Do we have another question? Great. We can take about two more.
I didn't know anything about your books, and I decided to take a look at one of them as it came in tonight. And then I was struck with this particular phrase, the dress rehearsal is a bird song. And I didn't understand the meaning of that. Perhaps you could elaborate.
Bird song is a rehearsal. I think it's that idea. What I love about birds is they just keep going over and over and over again. You know, it's the practice. And in the morning when you wake up, you know, I love that where I live, it's the chickadees. You know, that spring song, that... And they just, you know, or we have this relentless ruby-crowned kinglet that's just constantly, from dawn till dusk, even after, that is just singing, singing, singing. And it's like they're in rehearsal always. And here's a story about solitude. To me, the most beautiful bird that I know, bird song, is the thrush, wood thrush, hermit thrush. I remember one night listening to a hermit thrush singing between intervals of thunder. And I just thought, what can be more potent than that? And I was on assignment in Costa Rica, and we were looking for the quetzal bird. And so we were on our hands and knees going through, you know, these deeply, deeply wooded cloud forests. And all of a sudden, I was eye to eye with a wood thrush, and they're so hard to see, you know, on the East Coast. You rarely see them. And I was so excited, and my guide kept saying, no, that is not the quetzal, you know, that is not the quetzal. And I was just saying, but it's the wood thrush. And he goes, it's a bird we don't even know. It never sings. And when the wood thrush migrates to Costa Rica, it's silent.
Wow. Why?
I think it just needs some solitude, you know? I don't know.
Fair enough.
But rehearsal, you know? Staying still before or, you know, repeating. What I love about birdsong is that it reminds us most acutely that we are not alone. Mm. There are other species with us, and they feel like the representatives of other.
And are those mockingbirds are really with us in the morning?
Yeah,
really are. Do we have one more question? Over there. Hi.
Hi. I just came to sit down here. I was listening, and I like how magic just falls into you, you know, like around you, and how you said that paradox works with you in strange ways. And last month was John Cage's 100th, you know, anniversary or whatever, mm-hmm. and he's from LA, you know. And I came to a concert last month at the Colburn School, just around the block from here. They played, he was really influenced by Thoreau and Emerson, and they had like 9 different microphones, and they were reading off of Civil Disobedience.
How amazing.
Yeah, and they were playing it. It was a recording. No, there was a bunch of people reading it, and then after that, they played like Manhattan. He had like a recording of the sound of the morning time, and it was like birds and cars, and you know, you could just hear it getting louder and louder, you know, like the morning and life just, you know. And then how you said that they recorded you in your court hearing, and that kind of with John Cage and recordings and, you know, machines, and I thought that was really funny how you said that paradox works with you in strange ways. Mm.
Thank you for sharing that. And perhaps, you know, Mimi would always call that synchronicity, when the inner world and the outer world bow. Thank you so much.
Aloud is made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, the National Endowment for the Arts, Errant Fox, City National Bank, KPMG, Donna and Martin J. Wolf, and the Bujaki Foundation. Additional support provided by the Los Angeles Public Library, the Council of the Library Foundation, the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and individual Library Foundation members. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and LA Weekly. The Aloud theme was composed by Larry Karish.